At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
One of America's most interesting burial grounds has to be New Orleans' St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. St. Louis No. 1 is a maze of distinctive above-ground crypts built in the French style. Like so many things in New Orleans, the cemetery gives the impression that you're not in an American city. St. Louis No. 1 has more in common with the famous Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris than it does with most North American graveyards. And where Père Lachaise has its fair share of famous graves, being the final resting place of Chopin, Oscar Wilde, and Jim Morrison of The Doors, St. Louis Cemetery has its own catalog of dead notables, none of which is more famous than the voodoo queen, Marie Laveau. If you wind your way through the labyrinth of white-painted burial vaults, you may find yourself standing in front of a crypt at plot 347. Now, even before you read any of the plaques or inscriptions identifying the inhabitant of the tomb, you can easily tell that there's something a little different about this burial site. For years, you would have seen the tomb covered in X's scrawled with the crumbling bricks from other nearby graves. The X's are a symbol that's often used in voodoo and other magical traditions. The X is meant to act as a concentration point for magical energy. In front of the tomb, you might see offerings of rum, flowers, devotional candles, Mardi Gras beads, or cups filled with silver coins. You might even spot a thank you note or a positive pregnancy test humbly offered before the tomb. This is widely believed to be the final resting place of Marie Laveau. And for devotees of voodoo, this place is thought to have immense spiritual power. There's a tradition that if you perform the right ritual in front of the tomb, Marie Laveau, the powerful voodoo priestess, will grant your wish from beyond the grave. Now, what that wishing ritual actually is varies depending on who you ask. The famous New Orleans writer Robert Talent wrote that all you needed to do was, quote, knock three times on the slab and ask a favor, end quote. Simple enough. But others believe that to really make sure your wish comes true, you need to do a little more than that. In his book, Voodoo and Hoodoo, author Jim Haskins reported that the wishing ritual worked like this. Quote, draw the X, place your hand over it, rub your foot three times against the bottom, throw some silver coins into the cup, and make your wish. End quote. In the Encyclopedia of Ghosts and Spirits, the author Rosemary Gilley writes that petitioners need to, quote, leave offerings of food, money, and flowers, then ask for Marie's help after turning around three times and marking a cross with red brick on the stone, end quote. So, as you can see, there are a few different ways one can go about wishing at the tomb of Marie Laveau. Oral tradition has it that if your wish comes true, then you need to return to the grave and draw a little line through your original X, and then leave a final gift for the ghost of Marie Laveau. No final gift, and your wish might come undone in a terrible way. But discrepancies in the wishing ritual aren't the only controversy associated with the final resting place of Marie Laveau. You see, it's not entirely clear that the voodoo queen is actually interred at the tomb at plot 347. Even the bronze historical plaque marking the place hedges its bets, reading, quote, this Greek revival tomb is the reputed burial place of this notorious voodoo queen, end quote. The actual inscription on the tomb identifies it as belonging to Famille Veuve Perry, née Laveau, or the family of the widow Perry, born Laveau, which seems to suggest that this is the resting place of the famous priestess, who was also known as the widow Perry after her first husband. But this is complicated by the fact that the name and date of death carved into the tomb aren't quite right. Or at least they aren't quite right for it to be the original widow Perry in there. The name inscribed on the tomb is Marie Philomée Glapion. And then in French, it records the date of death as June 11th, 1897, and her age as 62 years old. Now that's 18 years after all the papers reported that the famous Marie Laveau died. Marie Philomée Glapion was not the name of the well-known voodoo priestess, but it was the name of one of her daughters. But maybe her daughter was the voodoo queen. Maybe they were both the voodoo queen. Maybe these two people somehow shared the same life, at least for a little while. I know this is getting twisty. How does any of this make sense? Were there really two Marie Laveaus? How would that work? Have voodoo devotees been making wishes in front of the wrong grave for more than a century? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 120, Who Was the Voodoo Queen of New Orleans, Part 3. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we are concluding our look at Marie Laveau, the legendary New Orleans voodoo priestess. As you've probably already figured out, this is part 3 in a trilogy of episodes on Laveau. There was so much mythology here that this one needed to be a 3-part treat. And you know me, I can't resist a trilogy. So, if you haven't listened to parts 1 and 2, you may want to go back and give them a listen now. In part 1, I did my best to explain the complex racial cultural gumbo that was Louisiana in the 19th century. I also dove into Marie Laveau's equally complicated ethnic heritage and tried to parse how that affected her life as the voodoo queen. In part 2, I spent most of the episode exploring voodoo itself, and I did my best to evaluate the different accounts of voodoo rituals witnessed in New Orleans during Marie Laveau's lifetime. Then I finished off part 2 by examining Marie Laveau's somewhat surprising history as a slave owner. This week, we are going to conclude our examination of the New Orleans voodoo queen, or should I say voodoo queens. As I've been teasing, one of the most fascinating parts of the Marie Laveau legend is the idea that she wasn't just one person. Some believe there was a figure known as Marie Laveau II. She was possibly the daughter of Marie Laveau, who stepped into her mother's role as voodoo queen in the later years of the elder Laveau's life. This led some to remember Marie Laveau as impossibly young-looking as she presumably neared her 100th birthday. But Other researchers think that Marie Laveau II didn't even exist, or at least not as a voodoo queen. This could just be more fake history. But before we get to that, there are a few other key aspects of Marie Laveau's life and legend that need to be unpacked. For instance, this entire series, I've been tossing around the term voodoo queen like that's a position we all totally understand. After the last episode, we might have a better sense of what a Laveauan voodoo ritual may have looked like, but I still really haven't explained what it meant to be the queen. Well, it turns out that the best way to answer that question is by looking at the history of a holiday in New Orleans known as St. John's Eve. So, without any further ado, let's take a closer look. St. John's Eve is a celebration that takes place on June 23rd, the night before the feast day of St. John the Baptist. The feast day celebration has been part of the Catholic liturgical calendar for centuries, but over time it took on a special significance in the French-speaking parts of North America. When France started to emerge as a colonial force in North America in the 16th and 17th centuries, the feast day had been particularly popular back home in the mother country, but it started being celebrated by French colonists with particular zest. It became just as much a celebration of French colonial identity as it did the saint, St. John the Baptist. Here in Canada, the day known as Saint Jean Baptiste is still a huge deal in Quebec and other French-speaking parts of the country. It's also basically a summer solstice festival, as it takes place just a few days after the longest day of the year. So yeah, you know, it's a pretty big party. Now, in Louisiana, this celebration was co-opted and reimagined by the black and mixed-race population there. Sometime in the mid-19th century, St. John's Eve became one of the most important nights in the voodoo calendar. Every year, a crowd of sincere devotees, uninitiated partiers, and inquisitive looky-loos of all races would gather on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain. There, huge bonfires would be lit, decorated barges would float out into the lake, dances would take place, and voodoo rites would be presided over by the reigning voodoo queen. Now, some sources like to credit Marie Laveau herself for starting the New Orleans St. John's Eve tradition. In 2017, the Smithsonian Magazine published an article entitled "Voodoo Priestess Marie Laveau Created New Orleans Midsummer Festival," where, you know, they argue exactly that. Citing some earlier reporting, the Smithsonian Magazine explains that, quote, "The holiday stretches back to the 1830s when famed voodoo priestess Marie Laveau started hosting annual feasts on the banks of Lake Pontchartrain." End quote. But this doesn't actually seem to be accurate. There are no primary sources that suggest that Marie Laveau created the ceremony or hosted the first ceremony. Historian Carolyn Merrill Long has pointed out that the St. John's Eve celebrations in New Orleans bear a striking resemblance to celebrations that happen in Haiti on the same night. Haitian voodoo practitioners have long celebrated the night with bonfires, dances, and rituals. In Haitian voodoo, St. John the Baptist is also worshipped as a minor loa, You might remember from part two that the Loas are the pantheon of deities worshipped in Haitian voodoo. So, Carolyn Merrill Long believes that the St. John's Eve traditions were likely brought to New Orleans by Haitian immigrants who arrived in the city in the early 1800s. So, St. John's Eve may be an example of Haitian voodoo influencing Louisiana voodoo. As I said before, it's often unclear exactly how much one tradition influenced the other, but St. John's Eve might be a moment where Haitian voodoo got its claws in the Louisiana variety. But even though it's unlikely that Marie Laveau invented the ritual, by the 1870s, it was clear that she was deeply associated with it. According to many accounts, the rituals on St. John's Eve were presided over by a high priestess known as, of course, the Voodoo Queen. In fact, the title Voodoo Queen may have been a position that was specific to the St. John's Eve ceremonies. Kind of like, you know, the prom queen, if that's not too glib a comparison. Because voodoo worship was so decentralized, throughout the year there were a lot of different priests and priestesses holding their own rituals. But on St. John's Eve, they all came together, and it was there that there could be only one voodoo queen. Now, what did the voodoo queen actually do? Well, once again, that all depends on who you ask. Unfortunately, we have no descriptions of St. John's Eve ceremonies from before the American Civil War. Now, this is kind of weird, especially when you consider the rash of police raids on voodoo ceremonies that took place in the 1850s. We spoke about a number of them in part two. Remarkably, none of those raids took place on St. John's Eve, which is something, because the St. John's Eve festivities were easily the most public displays of voodoo worship seen all year. Later descriptions seem to suggest that the local authorities may have turned a blind eye to the St. John's Eve ceremonies, which seems unusual, but it's also very New Orleans. Just turn a blind eye to the party. It also seems indicative of white New Orleans' love-hate relationship with voodoo. Sometimes voodoo is demonized as a destructive superstition, and other times it's tolerated and even celebrated as a unique bit of local culture. Anyway, this is all to say that all our descriptions of St. John's Eve come from after the Civil War. Now, these descriptions either play up the lasciviousness of the whole event in an attempt to denigrate the newly enfranchised black people, or they speak about it like it's past its prime. Like there used to be some cool voodoo here, but it ain't what it used to be. Many of these articles mention Marie Laveau, but only a few of them place her at St. John's Eve in person. The first known description of St. John's Eve to appear in the New Orleans papers comes from an article in the Commercial Bulletin from July 5th, 1869. Now, interestingly, this article also tells us that that year's festivities were marked by the retirement of Marie Laveau as the Voodoo Queen. Here's what the bulletin said, and be warned, this is another quote suffused with the racism of the era, so heads up. Quote, June is devoted by the voodoo worshippers to the celebration of their most sacred and therefore most revolting rites, midnight dances, bathing, and eating together, with other less innocent pleasures, make the early summertime a time of unrestrained orgies for the blacks. This season is marked by the coronation of a new voodoo queen in the place of the celebrated Marie Laveau, who has held her office for a quarter of a century and is now superannuated in her 70th year. Now a more youthful hand puts up love filters and makes fetishes for the intelligent freedmen who elect governors and members of Congress out of their own number. End quote. Whew. Okay, so there's a lot going on in that little passage. First, The description of St. John's Eve seems to be accurate, up to a point. The dancing, bathing, and feasting is something that would be described by countless witnesses. As for the orgies, well, once again, there's reason to believe that that's probably not true, as it doesn't seem to align with the memories of any of the oral history respondents who said they had attended St. John's Eve ceremonies. They talk a lot about eating gumbo and dancing all night, but no one mentions any group sex. But as you can see in the second part of the quote, this slander all seems to be serving the author's larger goal of denigrating recently freed and enfranchised slaves. The author sneers at the fact that in 1869, black people can now vote and run for office. He sarcastically calls them the intelligent freedmen. This trumped-up description of sexual voodoo rituals is being presented as evidence that black people don't deserve full civil rights. But just as interesting for those of us hunting for Marie Laveau in the archival record, here we are with a notice of her retirement as the voodoo queen. So if we trust the bulletin, then the first time we hear about St. John's Eve, it was the last time that Marie Laveau presided, or perhaps the time where she passed the torch to a new voodoo queen. But this claim is muddied by future articles. The next year, in 1870, the New Orleans Times reported that Marie Laveau had been spotted at St. John's Eve celebrations in, quote, all her queenly glory. In 1872, an unidentified reporter from the Times attended the St. John's Eve celebration and wrote one of the most detailed descriptions that we get from this period. According to him, not only was Marie Laveau at the St. John's Eve celebrations, she was running them. The writer reported that the ceremony began when Marie Laveau arrived on a decorated barge to a waiting crowd of nearly 300 revelers of all different races. As she stepped off her barge, she was greeted with cheers, and she then led the congregation in a Creole song, which basically translates to, "Make it hot, make it hot." Then the crowd started to build a massive bonfire, with each participant adding one piece of wood and making a wish as they threw it on the flames. Then, according to the reporter, the real exotic stuff went down. A boiling cauldron was placed over the fire, into which was put salt, black pepper, a black snake cut into three pieces, a black cat, a black rooster, and then some colored powders. All of these things were boiled together and then were taken out and saved for next year's celebration. At midnight, Marie Laveau commanded that everyone strip down and plunge into the lake, which, of course, they all did. After that, there was a huge feast of gumbo and jambalaya. After everyone had eaten their fill, they all formed a circle around Marie Laveau, who preached a sermon and then went around the circle giving her blessing to each person who had come. By this time, the sun was rising, and Marie told them all to go in peace. It's an interesting description, and most experts seem to think that it's probably accurate. You'll note that there's no mention of group sex. At its most scandalous, there was some skinny dipping. So this might be the most accurate and detailed description of Marie Laveau being a voodoo queen that we have. Except, not every expert is convinced that the woman described actually was Marie Laveau. Some believe that the woman described in this piece seems too young and healthy to have been Marie Laveau, who at this time would have been 71 years old. Some have speculated that this may have been a different voodoo queen, perhaps the woman who supposedly took over in 1869, according to the commercial bulletin. Maybe she was misidentified as Marie Laveau by the writer. Or maybe this was the mysterious Marie Laveau II. Now, Personally, I don't think it's entirely out of the question that this could have been the real Marie Laveau. I mean, I've met some pretty sprightly people in their early 70s. And I know 70 meant something a little different in the mid-1800s than it does now, but I still think it's possible that this was Marie Laveau. But it is notable that after this 1872 description of St. John's Eve, Marie Laveau is never again mentioned as attending the event or presiding as Voodoo Queen. All future descriptions always point to other women as the High Priestess. Most often, a woman named Mama Caroline is identified as the presiding Voodoo Queen. In the mid-1870s, more and more reporters started attending the St. John's Eve ceremonies, most of them hoping to see Marie Laveau, but all of them came away disappointed when she was nowhere to be found. Take, for example, another Times reporter who trekked out to Lake Pontchartrain for the St. John's Eve celebrations in 1874. He was there to hopefully see Marie Laveau in action. But he was decidedly less impressed by what he saw than his colleague in 1872. He didn't see Marie Laveau. Instead, he got someone who was a decidedly less glamorous voodoo queen, who he said was, quote, presiding over an unexceptional dance party, end quote. He then went on to editorialize, quote, the fact is that the voodoos are no more, and their mysterious ceremonies have degenerated into a time of unrestrained license for the Negroes, when they can get drunk and indulge in their idiotic pranks without fear of interference from the police, end quote. Okay, there's a lot to unpack in that little statement. First of all, it's just dripping with casual racism. But perhaps more interesting is the sentiment that voodoo used to be something better, something more admirable, and now, according to this guy, it's been degraded. Now, this is what I'm talking about when I say that white New Orleans had a love-hate relationship with voodoo. White reporters disparaged and belittled voodoo for decades. And then, as soon as it looks like it's gone, they're kind of disappointed. At least, this reporter seems a touch nostalgic for the old voodoo. He kind of reminds me of a snobby music critic in the 1970s who never really got punk. And then he goes to a show at CBGB's in like 1979, a couple years past prime, and declares, ugh, punk's dead. It's like, dude, do you even really know what you're talking about? From the descriptions in the papers, it's clear that St. John's Eve celebrations continued well into the 1880s. But the event seems to have been constantly evolving. Some years, the paper describe more sincere forms of voodoo devotion, whereas other years they describe a commercial event, a carnival that's put on mostly for the benefit of tourists or locals looking for a good party. Kind of reminds me of what's become of New Orleans Mardi Gras. But while the event may have become less authentic and more commercial, at least according to the city's reporters, who all of a sudden became voodoo purists at this time, its death wasn't brought about by its commercialization. Instead, it was undone by legislation. In 1877, the Reconstruction era came to an ignoble end. To secure the support of Southern politicians in a contested presidential election, a compromise was reached that led to the permanent withdrawal of federal troops from the American South. With the troops gone, the so-called Jim Crow era began. The traditional white power brokers reasserted themselves and set about disenfranchising black Americans. This took the form of new laws designed to suppress the black vote, restrict black people from running for office, and segregating all public spaces. In Louisiana, the changes wrought by the Jim Crow laws were arguably the most jarring in all of the South. Even though slavery had existed in Louisiana since the French colonial days, Slaves in Louisiana had considerably more liberty than many of their contemporaries in places like Mississippi or Alabama. Louisiana also had a sizable population of mixed-race free people of color, of which Marie Laveau was a part. Remember, the free people of color occupied a very unique place in antebellum Louisiana society. They had never been slaves, and therefore enjoyed many, though not all, of the same rights as white Louisianans. Jim Crow laws essentially eliminated their place in Louisiana society. Under the new laws, free people of color were now considered black. Yet another example of how your race can change depending on who has power. Right up to the Civil War, mixing between black, white, and free people of color in Louisiana, and especially in New Orleans, had been common, though discouraged, but common. The descriptions of the voodoo rites attest to this. But segregation laws now made race a binary thing. You were either black or white, and it became illegal for black people to go where white people were. The most stark and upsetting example of this is the fate of the legendary Congo Square. Congo Square was a gathering place in the Treme neighborhood, just north of the French Quarter. In 1817, it was designated by the mayor of New Orleans as the one legal place where black slaves could congregate on their day off, Sunday. As a result, Congo Square became a unique hub of black culture and music. It was a place where traditions, songs, and dances from Africa were able to live on. It was also a place where voodoo thrived. Legend has it that Marie Laveau herself conducted voodoo rituals at Congo Square. There was really no other place like it in the antebellum South, and it became a key part of the cultural life of New Orleans. Congo Square even eventually became a venue for Creole brass bands. These were the bands that basically invented jazz. Now, in 1893, at the height of Jim Crow, all the people now considered black were banned from Congo Square. Imagine that, banning black people from the home of African culture in North America. To add insult to injury, the city chose to rename the park Beauregard Park, after the Confederate general, P.G.T. Beauregard. St. John's Eve, and voodoo in general, was similarly legislated out of existence. While both practices were never explicitly banned, a series of laws essentially did the trick of suppressing it. An 1879 city ordinance banning loitering, disorderly conduct, and exposing the body in public gave the authorities new grounds to disrupt St. John's Eve and other voodoo rituals. An 1881 rule required permission to be granted for any kind of religious gathering. And wouldn't you know it, voodoo practitioners had a real hard time getting permits. In 1887, a state law forbade practicing medicine for pay without a license, which seems completely reasonable. However, it seems to have specifically targeted traditional healers and voodoo root workers. Finally, in 1897, New Orleans passed an ordinance that straight up banned fortune telling. All of these laws served to drive voodoo even deeper underground than it had already been. By the 1890s, St. John's Eve had all but vanished, and public voodoo rites were basically unheard of. And predictably, articles started to be written about the good old days when Marie Laveau held her rituals on St. John's Eve. Perhaps appropriately, the decline of voodoo in New Orleans seems to align neatly with the death of Marie Laveau in 1881. The scene just wasn't the same without its queen. That is, of course, if Marie Laveau actually did die in 1881. Perhaps Marie Laveau lived on for nearly two more decades. Or was this actually the mysterious Marie Laveau II? Let's take a break, And when we come back, let's see if we can get to the bottom of this last weird mystery. A huge number of sources all attest to the fact that Marie Laveau died in 1881. As I examined in part one, long obituaries for the Voodoo Queen ran in multiple New Orleans papers, and a retrospective of her life was even published in the New York Times in 81. So you would be justified in asking why anyone would question the date of her death. Well, this goes to the problem with oral histories, especially when you're collecting them from older people. People sometimes don't remember things entirely clearly, especially when they're in their 70s or 80s and they're being asked about their childhoods. This is the case with many of the interviews conducted by the Louisiana Writers Project. Now, don't get me wrong, I think there is quite a lot of value in oral histories, and these interviews in particular are often invaluable sources when it comes to the life of Marie Laveau. But that doesn't mean that they aren't also full of incompatible claims. Many of the respondents remembered that in the 1870s, Marie Laveau was a wizened old woman who rarely left her St. Anne Street cottage. This fits with descriptions of her written in the Daily Picayune newspaper in both 1875 and 1879. But that's not how some of the interviewees remembered her. More than one informant remembered Marie Laveau as being a fierce, young-looking woman who walked the streets of New Orleans with an intimidating confidence well into the 1890s. Many of these interviews described a woman who looked no more than 40 or maybe 50. One informant for the Louisiana Writers Project claimed that in the 1880s, Marie Laveau, quote, walked on the streets as unconcerned as any watcherwoman, smiling and speaking to those she met. People would stand aside and whisper, "Here comes Marie Laveau," end quote. Another informant would remember that in the late 1880s, Marie Laveau was, quote, a tall, good-looking woman. She might have been mistaken for South American. She had fine features and straight black hair. She must have been 50 or 60 at the time, end quote. A third Louisiana Writers Project interviewee would remember knowing Marie Laveau in 1895 and commenting that at that time she, quote, looked about 50, end quote. So, how does any of this make sense? How could Marie Laveau have been both an old woman and a young woman at the same time? Well, the legend is that Marie Laveau's daughter, Marie Philomée Glapion, who also lived at the St. Anne Street cottage, started impersonating her mother sometime in the early 1870s. Marie Philomée was said to host voodoo rituals and would appear at the St. John's Eve ceremonies claiming that she was her mother. This gave the impression to the amazed onlookers that Marie Laveau had been blessed with a kind of eternal youth. The story goes that by the time of the original Marie Laveau's death, Marie Philomée had completely taken over as the Voodoo Queen. Fans of The Princess Bride might recognize this as the Dread Pirate Roberts trick. It's all about keeping that name alive. As such, Marie Philomée is often called Marie Laveau II. Now, you will find lots of internet sources that will present the existence of Marie Laveau II as an uncontested fact. There, you will hear the story that she took over her mother's magical practice and reigned as Voodoo Queen until her own death in 1897. What's more, it's often reported that this second Marie Laveau was crueler and more malicious than her mother. But is there anything to this story? Was there a real Marie Laveau II? Well, the first researcher to really put this idea out there was a journalist by the name of G. William Knott. In 1915, he did some research into the life of Marie Laveau, and he became convinced that the widow Perry, or the original Marie Laveau, actually had not been the Voodoo Queen. He thought that Marie's daughter, Marie Eloise, was the real Voodoo Queen, Marie Laveau. And he described her as, quote, a dangerous woman, wicked in the truest sense of the word, end quote. So Knott didn't think that two women shared a life. He just thought that the Marie Laveau of voodoo infamy wasn't the widow Perry. Now, this idea was later picked up by the writer Lyle Saxon. In his 1928 book, Fabulous New Orleans, he took the Marie Eloise theory and made the bold claim that she and her mother, Marie Laveau, had actually shared a life. He claimed that Marie Laveau II, who he thought was Marie Eloise, had been known to police since she was a young woman and was a worker of black magic. According to Lyle Saxon, after the first Marie Laveau passed away, the daughter stepped seamlessly into the role of Voodoo Queen. But she gained a fearsome reputation, and according to the writer, quote, her name is still used to frighten children today, end quote. But it was really Robert Talent, the ultimate Marie Laveau biographer and mythmaker, who really enshrined the idea that there were two Marie Laveaus. In his book, Voodoo in New Orleans, Talent wrote that, quote, there is evidence that a dynasty was established in an attempt to pass the rule of the cult from mother to daughter. It seems also to have been a deliberate attempt to found a legend of immortality. End quote. According to Talent, after Laveau's alleged retirement, she entered her home on St. Anne Street and didn't leave until her death in 1881. At this time, Marie II emerged, except it probably wasn't her daughter Marie Eloise, it was her other daughter, Marie Philomée. And I know this is confusing because everyone in this family is named Marie. It was a tradition. But here's the thing. The evidence for a Marie Laveau II and an immortality ruse is extremely skimpy. First of all, there is no mention of a second Marie Laveau or a daughter of Marie Laveau succeeding her mother until 1915 in that William Knott article. Historian Carolyn Merrill Long has pointed out that in the 19th century, there were a number of different people, men and women, who were named by the New Orleans papers as Marie Laveau's successor. And none of them were Marie Laveau's daughter. In 1873, Mama Caroline was named as the new Voodoo Queen. In 1875, the presiding Voodoo Queen at St. John's Eve was a certain Madame Frazee. In 1884, a woman by the name of Malvina Latour was acknowledged as the Voodoo Queen. And by the way, that is the coolest sounding voodoo name I've ever heard. Malvina Latour. Oh, I like that. In 1894, the writer John Castellanos claimed that Dr. Jim Alexander, quote, succeeded Marie Laveau in her occupation of dupery, end quote. Ah, dupery. Love that. So during the supposed reign of Marie II, the contemporary sources never once claimed that someone calling themselves Marie Laveau was acting as leader of the city's voodoo worshippers. The closest thing you get is that somewhat robust-sounding description of Marie Laveau from 1872. I mean, that may have been her daughter standing in. But since the original Marie was still alive in 1872, it seems hardly necessary. But for the most part, it seems very clear that Marie Laveau II was not a voodoo queen post-1881. But then, how do you explain all those sightings of a young-looking Marie Laveau all the way up to 1895? Well, here's the thing. It is true that Marie Laveau's daughter, Marie Philomée Glapion, lived in the St. Anne Street cottage in the late 19th century. She also roughly fits the description of the people interviewed by the Louisiana Writers Project. So it seems entirely likely that those informants certainly did see a Marie Laveau walking the streets of New Orleans, but it was actually just Marie Philomée. What they perhaps misremembered was that she wasn't the original Widow Perry, and that she wasn't the reigning voodoo queen. She was someone that clearly had clout and respect in the neighborhood because, you know, she was the daughter of Marie Laveau, but she wasn't the Marie Laveau. Now, it's unclear if Marie Philomée hosted voodoo rituals or not. Some of the Louisiana Writers Project informants say she did. And honestly, it's entirely possible. It could also help explain some of the confusion. Imagine if the neighborhood had more than one voodoo woman named Marie living in the same house hosting rituals. You know, things could get kind of blurry in your memory. But even if that is the case, it doesn't seem like Marie Philomée was consciously trying to impersonate her mother or inspire a myth of immortality. She certainly had not taken over for her mother in any meaningful way. Now, this brings us back to that grave in St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. The name on that grave is Marie Philomée Glapion, but another inscription also says that it belongs to the family of the Widow Perry. So, most experts believe that both women are actually buried at that site. Marie Philomée in one of the crypts, and the Widow Perry, potentially, in the lower vault. So, it seems clear that the story of Marie Laveau II is a historical myth, cooked up sometime in the early 20th century. But that myth seems to speak to a deeper truth about Marie Laveau. For many, she never really stopped walking the streets of New Orleans. And indeed, her ghost is still thought to haunt the Crescent City. There's a story that in the mid-1930s, a man named Elmore James stepped into a drugstore just across the street from St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. Elmore was waiting to be served when a woman wearing a perfectly wrapped tignon headdress stepped in behind him. The owner of the store took one look at the woman and immediately bolted for the back of the establishment. Elmore just stood there confused. He turned around and looked at the woman, and she asked him, "Don't you know who I am?" Elmore just said, "No, ma'am." With that, the woman slapped Elmore across the face and sent him crashing to the floor. Then she levitated in front of him and flew out the door, over the telephone lines and over St. Louis Cemetery No. 1, where she promptly disappeared. A few moments later, Elmore was being revived by the store's owner. He gave the still-dazed Elmore some whiskey and said, "Son, you just met Marie Laveau." Now, who knows if that story's true? But either way, it hammers home a very important point. Alive or dead, New Orleans is still very much Marie Laveau's town. So you best pay your respect. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will explore another historical myth. Before we go this week, I need to give a shout-out to the following people. Big ups to Catherine Euler, to Erica Belil, to Roxanne Smith, to Lewis B. Shipper, to Bradley G. Wall, to Anna Wasson, to Carly Cooper, to Colt Cube or Colt Cube, to Brian C. Stewart, to Jim DeRose, to Meredith Busick, to Amy Sophie or Amy Soph, to Chris Schulman, and to Anna Looney. All of those people have chosen to support the podcast at $5 or more every month on Patreon. So you know what that means. You're beautiful human beings. Thanks again to everyone who supports this show in big ways and in small ways. But those Patreon supporters, I gotta give a lot of extra love to you folks. You are what is keeping this show going and will keep it going for a very long time. So thank you again for your support. But there's other ways to support the show. If you don't have extra money to be supporting on Patreon, maybe just think about writing a nice review or giving us a 5-star rating on your favorite app or something like that. It goes a long way. So if you want to support the show but you don't got the extra money, just write a review. They're free to do and it helps us out. If you do want to support on Patreon, then go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and see what level of support works for you. There's awesome extras at the $1, $3, and $5 levels, so get on it. There's more cool stuff coming, too. If you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Facebook. That's facebook.com/ourfakehistory. Or you can hit me up on Twitter at Our Fake History. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out more from Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.